Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Today is the final segment in our seven-part franchise legal series, which is also our third annual legal series and also the last in our third complete season on Franchise Today. And as always, my co-producer, Joe Caruso, is with me. Joe, it's been an exciting third season, certainly been an exciting third legal series.
Yeah, I think you're right. The attorneys have really ratcheted this up. I don't think a lot of people know how the process that we go through in devising these shows, but we get a lot of input from the attorneys, and now that they've been on a number of times or they've heard previous shows, you know, they kind of want to be better than their peers, or they want to really bring great information to the audience. So that makes it even more challenging for us in producing these and creating the questions. But I'll tell you, the guests have been great. The attorneys have been unbelievably helpful in crafting the show so that they're relevant to the audience and to people in franchising. So thanks to all the people that participated.
Yes, certainly it's brought our knowledge level up a few bits as well, because we do spend a lot of time, and you specifically spend a lot of time working with the attorneys, crafting the show, making sure there's no surprises, making sure it's relevant, adjusting the pace of the show according to my quickness in speaking and some of the attorneys' fast-paced talking, as well as some of the slow ones. So it's really been a remarkable job this year, and special kudos to you on that.
Well, thank you.
You know, it has been a great year, as well as the ending series, and I think it's so appropriate to end our third season on such a high note with the legal series. For our listening audience and some that are just listening for the first time today, give us kind of a recap of where we've been on this year's legal series.
Okay. Well, I'll give a rundown of all of our previous shows and also take time to remind people that all the shows are available on podcasts. So if there's a show of particular interest that they want to hear again or they want to share with somebody else, all you have to do is go to blogtalkradio.com/franchisetoday, and you can get retrieve that show, and you can certainly email it to your friends or other people in franchising. But you know, we started the third annual legal series back on April 12th, and our leadoff attorney was Lane Fisher, and he spoke about private equity in franchising, due diligence, and deal making. And great show, great topic, because there's certainly a lot of deal-making happening at the franchisor level and at the franchisee level. I mean, we just had Burger King make an investment in its largest franchisee, and actually the franchisor sitting on the board of that franchisee. So that's a very interesting deal. And if you look at Monday's Wall Street Journal, you'll see a quote by me in an article related to Burger King. On the 19th, we had Lee Plave from Plave Cook talk about social media and technology, a moving target for franchising. Plave Cook has been a great supporter of the show and of the series, and we've had at least one attorney on each of our three series and sometimes more. Then we followed up with another attorney from Plave Cook, Mark Kirsch, and he talked about safety and vigilance, leveraging franchise sales outsourcing. Not to be outdone, Warren Lewis followed on with franchise compliance, basics, and earnings claims. Then we had Ken Prine, litigation and technology in franchising. It's complicating. Fascinating show on information law. I was surprised at how interesting the show was, because we gave Ken such a challenging and difficult subject, and he made it really, really interesting and relevant to what we do in franchising. And then we had last week our good friend Michael Webster, and he did a show on dynamics of winning franchisee and franchisee relationships. So that kind of brings us up to date with today's show.
Yeah, also, Warren Lewis, with respect to franchise sales best practices, and of course his franchise seller's handbook, which he's made available at no charge, a signed copy, by the way, to anybody that listened to the show. And if you have not inquired about receiving that copy, you know, you can do so direct to Warren at Ackerman Center Feet, or also on the Franchise Today Facebook page. And as Joe mentioned, all segments of Franchise Today in the legal series are available on demand. There'll also be a direct link on the Franchise Essentials blog site at fmdpro.com. Right now, there's the second legal series access. After today's show, you'll see the third. Also, I wanted to remind everybody, as we go on hiatus for the summer, and quite frankly, it's a necessity. A lot of hours are put in week in and week out, and we need a break too at times. And during this break period, we'll be replaying all three legal series and a few other segments of Franchise Today, and some people just like to be able to listen to them on a weekly basis as opposed to accessing them on demand, and we certainly appreciate that. And again, it's blogtalkradio.com /Franchise Today Show, and you'll be able to access that. And also, I'll have links to all the legal series in a blog post within the next week, and we'll populate it out through social media. So if you forget the link, certainly you'll be reminded and be able to focus in on a couple of the episodes and segments that really of the most interest to you. And Joe, wrapping up today, we're coming out of the IFA Legal Symposium 2012, and our guest this morning on Franchise Today is Ursa Jackson, a Dallas-based franchise attorney, certified franchise executive, which I'm always impressed when an attorney proceeds to achieve that designation, because it is a lot of work. She's also a partner at Strasburger and Price. She's the practice area leader for Strasburger's Franchise and Distribution Law Group. Ursa structures franchises for franchisors and assists client companies with ongoing transactional and litigation needs. And she not only attended this year's IFA Legal Symposium, she was also one of the speakers on the symposium's 2012 Judicial Update. Ursa, welcome, welcome, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to be on the show today. It's my pleasure.
You know, being a Texas attorney, you and I have not had the pleasure of meeting as of yet, which is probably a little bit unusual, being my entire franchise career has been spent here in Texas. So I certainly look forward to meeting you in the future, and maybe I'll come up to Dallas for a franchise network meeting or something like that in the future.
Super, super.
You know, as I mentioned, Ursa, in your introduction, you presented a judicial update Tuesday morning with Leonard McPhee, covering trends in the franchise relationship, compliance, dispute resolution, registration, disclosure, antitrust, professional responsibility, and other important issues. And I'm sure we probably could talk an hour on all of that today easily, but could you share with the audience today some of the finer points from your session?
Certainly, certainly would be glad to. This year, about 500 franchise legal professionals gathered in Washington, D.C. for the 45th annual IFA Legal Symposium. It was a pleasure to present that. I will try and highlight some of the interesting developments from the presentation and the paper that we prepared. You know, despite franchisors' best efforts to avoid disputes with franchisees, a franchisor is bound to get sued at some point. To best protect itself in the event of litigation, a franchisor really should be thinking about war in a time of peace. Now, what I mean by that is statements to a franchisee made in a disclosure document or a franchise agreement or training, all those things at the front end are important to make sure that when there is a dispute that you're properly protected. One of the cases that I want to just highlight briefly really drives home the point that it's important to make sure not only that the training is done well, but that your disclosure document stands up against scrutiny. In the Benneking case that we discussed this year at the symposium, there were some fraud issues in that case. The franchisee alleged that there were some representations that amounted to fraud. Now, at first blush, you might be thinking Benneking has trouble on its hands. One of the allegations was if you can earn as much as a physician. Another allegation, if you buy more, you get more. Another allegation the franchisee made that amounted to fraud was you'd be able to work in this business for a long time. Now, the court looked at each of those statements. The statement that was made that you could earn as much as a physician, we normally say that's no-no. However, in this case, it wasn't actionable because the statement was made after the franchise agreement was signed. So no fraud, no fraudulent inducement on that statement. Now, obviously, we like to avoid that making types of statements like that where we can't substantiate them. The statement, if you buy more, you get more, was actually in the document. But because of the way the system is set up, that franchise system, that statement was actually substantially true. The franchisee actually purchases a certain amount of accounts, and those accounts are delivered to the franchisee. The statement, work in the business for a long time, the court chalked that up to good old-fashioned puffery in the context of a franchise sales arrangement. So no actionable fraud there. Another case that we highlighted is actually a 7-Eleven case that where the franchisee alleged that 7-Eleven misrepresented or omitted certain information in its disclosure document. 7-Eleven did make an earnings claim in its UFOC. What 7-Eleven properly disclosed is that the disclosure only related to units that were open for 1 year or more. The unit that was purchased by the franchisee was open less than a year. Franchisee argued that 7-Eleven should have provided information on this unit, especially since the unit allegedly was unprofitable, had some warts on it, if you will. The court looked at the disclosure document, the qualification language that 7-Eleven provided, and said no actionable fraud in this case. First of all, 7-Eleven properly disclosed how the criteria for inclusion in the disclosure document, and franchisee knew of that language and knew that the location that it purchased was open for less than a year. So no actionable fraud in that case. Two cases that highlight making sure your disclosure documents will stand up to scrutiny. Now, I'd like to shift gears a bit and talk about a couple of cases under the intellectual property umbrella. These two cases I want to highlight merely because they're not the run-of-the-mill type cases. One is a copyright case in which a franchise system designated specific decor for all of its company stores but also franchise locations in the U.S. and outside the U.S. Now, what was problematic is there is a photo that the franchisor required all the units to display. The plaintiff in that case alleged that she owned that photo and that the franchisor didn't have the right to use those. Now, that sort of raises a lot of eyebrows and will force any franchise system to consider the decor. I mean, that's typically not the type of thing that the franchisor gets sued for. They've got lots of things out there that they get sued for. That's not the run of the mill. So that should cause all franchise systems to think about the copyright side of things. Now, another case that came up under the Lanham Act was a counterfeit case. Now, typically we see the run-of-the-mill Lanham Act case where a franchisee gets sued for improperly using the marks, and it's just a pure run-of-the-mill Lanham Act case. Well, in a Century 21 case this year, a dispute arose when Century 21 terminated a franchisee for failure to pay all of the amounts that were due under the agreement. Century 21 demanded that the franchisee de-identify and stop operating the competing business. Franchisee pursued the competing business and just completely blew Century 21 off. Century 21, in addition to those run-of-the-mill dilution claims, improper use of the mark, alleged counterfeit claim in this case. Now, there are four elements beyond the mere infringement or false advertising that must be shown if you're going to prevail on a counterfeit claim. One is that the mark must be, quote, counterfeit or a spurious mark, which is identical or substantially indistinguishable from a registered mark. The second requirement is that it must be registered on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office's principal register for use for the same goods or services in which the dispute arose. The defendant must have not been authorized to use the mark at the time that the services were manufactured or produced, and the defendant must have acted with knowledge and intent. An interesting thing here, and the court drew no distinction between having a right to formally use it and being unauthorized at the time of use. The court held that continued use, even by an unlicensed former franchisee, could constitute counterfeit. Court couldn't conceive of any reason why an ex-franchisee should escape liability for counterfeiting. So in the future, there are likely to be more of those types of claims cropping up where the franchisee starts competing business and openly refuses to comply with a demand. There are a number of cases that discuss vicarious liability. That's always a recurring theme in these cases. We highlighted a Valero case during the symposium that's worth mentioning here today, just because this is one where truly bad facts made bad law in that case. A court held that Valero could be held vicariously liable for the activities and operations of the retailer on property. Now, at the convenience store, there was a customer that came into the gas station with a guide dog and was actually physically assaulted by an employee attempting to deny the plaintiff access because of the guide dog. Not a good thing. The court said that a liability could be imputed to Valero because, in fact, Valero designated some of the operations that resulted allegedly in this incident in the first place. Now, this is not the type of thing that you would normally see a franchisor being hit for vicarious liability for. I think in this case, truly one where bad facts made bad law in this case, and I don't see this being a recurring theme in the future. Now, there were a number of cases that talked about relationship laws and what good cause was for termination that are worth highlighting merely because they set the stage for additional consideration. In a Mazda case that we discussed, there was a dealer terminated because of a felony conviction. Now, the dealer statute at issue clearly said that was just cause or good cause under the statute for termination. What the dealer came in and successfully argued is that, yes, you're right, this is what the statute says, but that's not the only remedy that's available to me. Franchisor, you must also comply with your contract. Your contract requires that there is a substantial impact on the business, the franchise, or other franchised locations, and that was the only grounds for termination upon a felony conviction. In other words, the court said, yes, the statute sets the floor, but not the ceiling. The additional language in the dealer agreement is not counter to the statute, and we will honor that obligation. Franchisor, you must comply with the heightened standard. There were a number of cases that we highlighted in our paper that related to what we call specialty industries, beer manufacturers. Now, the statute itself requires that there's good cause to terminate a dealer. Where a successor manufacturer comes into play, the successor manufacturer gets a pass on meeting the standard for good cause. So you can imagine that this is attractive where a system wants to clean up some of its dealer network. A number of cases came up in Ohio where this exact thing happened. Now, where there's a joint venture that's created and that's the successor, the court's going to look at the control that's maintained. There was one case where the prior manufacturer was a member of the joint venture that was the successor dealer, and they retained voting rights and a control over the joint venture. Court said no go in that case. So let's contrast that with another case cited where there was truly an arm's length transaction where the ownership actually changed hands. In that case, the court said, yes, that's the type of successor manufacturer that this statute is designed to protect. In that case, good cause is not required. So those highlight some of the cases. We could spend hours sort of dissecting a lot of these, and I think we're going to hit some of the other key issues as we proceed with our questions.
Hey, Ursa, this is Joe. It brings to mind some of the things you pointed out. You mentioned Janneking. There seems to be a great deal of confusion about the implications for franchising regarding the Coverall case in Massachusetts. The reason I bring that up, the Coverall and Janneking are in the same space.
Right.
Maybe you could briefly describe the Coverall case for listeners new to franchising or who have just haven't been paying attention to the Coverall matter. I'm sure it came up at the IFA Legal Symposium, because it comes up a lot in conversations that I have with attorneys, and everybody's got an opinion. But if you could kind of briefly describe it and tell us about it.
Certainly. In the Coverall case, Coverall handles a lot of the back office operations, if you will. With the normal franchise arrangement the courts are used to seeing, there's not as much back office assistance. For instance, Coverall, like other brands, will help with accounts, help with monitoring those accounts, will help with getting the leads and all of that. So to a court who is not used to looking at a franchise arrangement, this might start to look like an employee-employer type arrangement. For those of us who work in the industry, that couldn't be further from the truth. These are actually independent business owners and operators. Our agreements provide as such, and as franchisors, we rely on that line being drawn. It's not the intention of the franchisor to designate every aspect of the franchisee's business. But in the janitorial space, it's typical for the franchisor to do lots of these things, and it starts to look like an employer-employee relationship. In the Coverall case, the court did find that there was an employee-employer relationship. That sent ripples through the franchise industry. In fact, when we presented on this issue at the symposium, we had a great slide that said, what keeps franchisors up at night? And clearly, if there is any one area of franchise law that's kept franchisors up at night, it's been this line of cases. There have been other cases. Yes.
Ursa, it's interesting, you talk about the back office stuff that Coverall did, and the other services that they provide. They all sounded like really great things to support a franchisee. And I think it's difficult for franchisors, since I come from that side of the equation, to get their arms around, well, if I'm really helping them and I'm making their business life easier, how is this overreaching, or how is my over-assistance causing me such grief and having these people turn into employees?
Well, Joe, very good question. I don't think that this is really going to get turned on its head for a couple of reasons. One is there is a recent case, Janneking case out of California, where the court comes out on the opposite side. So we've got some help in California where franchisors have had sort of a hard road on a number of issues. Now, the distinction there is more of a legal distinction where the courts came out. They looked at whether there's a rebuttable presumption. So where a plaintiff can demonstrate that services are being performed for another party and essentially back office is being done by one, there is almost a rebuttable presumption that employer-employee relationship exists. That's in the normal course where you're looking at the run-of-the-mill case. What the Janikin court said is that that presumption didn't apply in the franchise context, particularly given that this space is already regulated. I think that that's the more reasoned side of things, and I think that that's where it's going to come down. In the Janikin case, the court found that under California law that a franchisee must show that the franchisor exerted control beyond what's necessary to protect and maintain its interest in the trademark, trade name, goodwill, and in order to establish a prima facie case, the franchisee would have to meet this heightened standard. So what the California case, it was actually to ratchet up the standard. The California case is probably the more reason because from a franchisor standpoint, this is a valuable service that's offered to franchisees. I think that this case is, or this line of cases is probably going to get remedied by legislation, quite frankly. One of the things that we talked about during the case during the symposium that the IFA is looking at are pending bills and trying to figure out where these bills are going. There are some bills that have been presented on the independent contractor nature just to respond to the coverall, the Janikin line of cases.
That's probably a really good thing for the IFA to be concerned with because if people take notice, most of our states in the United States are broke. And because they're broke, they want every independent contractor to be classified as an employee so that they're insured that they're going to get their state tax revenue. And this is not a very well-disguised revenue hunt by state attorney general's offices, and it's pretty clear. But setting aside the overreach and overassistance aspect for franchisors, because that filters into other areas other than, you know, classification of employees. I mean, you've got direct and vicarious liability for doing things that you, as a franchisor, you really shouldn't do for the franchisee. But that, we could do another whole show on that. Do you expect that there's going to be more of these reclassification or misclassification suits?
Unfortunately, I foresee that there are going to be more. Let me just throw out a couple of states where there is some type of independent contractor bill. There is one that's in the works in Delaware, in Georgia, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island right now. I think that there are probably going to be more of these, but unfortunately, I think there will be more of these suits before legislation happens.
All right.
And unfortunately, the franchisors are going to have to continue to deal with this. I think on a grand scheme of things, I think it's going to get worked out. I think that once the legislators get educated as to this being a benefit, this is assistance that franchisees actually want. It's going to help them with their business. I think part of the task is educating not only the courts but educating the legislators about how franchising works. You'd be surprised at how few of them really understand how it works, and that's one of the goals that when the IFA does its fall program, it actually goes to the Capitol to speak with legislators to push some of the agendas that actually benefit both franchisors and franchisees.
You know, Ursa, obviously you mentioned, you know, Janikin, you mentioned Coverall. There are other franchisors in that space, and you typically see newcomers as the fastest-growing franchise systems growing in that space as well, most recent being Stratus Building Solutions and some others. To them, as well as to other franchisors, what are some of the tips that you would give in order to avoid classification of franchisees as employees?
Well, one of the things is to really look at kind of what's sort of necessary and bare bones as far as the assistance goes, and trying to take your hands off of what's not really essential to the business and essential to the brand. That's going to require kind of some soul searching as to what we can live with franchisees sort of doing at their own devise. And that's going to just kind of vary from system to system as to what will be critical. Because it's catch-22. Franchisors need some control. When you think about franchising, it's that consistency from location to location, from unit to unit, that makes franchising great. And so there are some things that you don't want to vary. It's not negotiable. I mean, it really comes down to what are the things for our brand that are not negotiable, and that we have to take a business risk on those. These are the things that are required franchisees. And franchisors, they take a business risk because these are things that are critical to the brand.
Yeah, certainly there's that fine line between, you know, processes and procedures, systems, compliance, and then, of course, the daunting word that a lot of people don't like, which is control. So that should be interesting. We're on Franchise Today. It is halfway through our final segment in our third annual legal series. My guest today has been at the IFA Legal Symposium this week. And, of course, this is Ursa Jackson, a Dallas-based franchise attorney and CFE and partner at Strasburger & Price. And, of course, you're giving us some great information, Ursa, especially with respect to cases that have been, I guess, troubling a lot of franchisors at night. So I think that was definitely a good topic headline, you know, what's keeping franchisors at night awake. You know, one of the session topics at the symposium was regrets. If dreams came true, provisions you wish you had or didn't have in your franchise agreement. What were some of the examples given in this session?
Certainly, certainly. I'd like to start with territories because that brings up lots of questions about sort of wishes and regrets. In some instances, there were discussions about exclusive territories being provided when that wasn't really the best thing down the road. But, of course, if you grant the exclusive, you've got to deal with that. We discussed in some detail about reservation of rights and, you know, what the franchisor wants to hold back. For the new systems, it's sort of a great time to be coming onto the scene because you get to see where some of the older systems are now dealing with growing pains. Do you want to hold back national accounts, non-traditional venues? That's always an issue as a concept expands and the concept realizes there are some opportunities for us. For instance, let's take the food industry and deciding, hey, we'd like to go into grocery stores now, or in a space where you decide we want the internet business. So considering reservations of rights, a lot of franchisors have regrets that they did not reserve rights properly. So for the new systems, that's something that's very important. Also, issues arise on the territory end of things about who gets to operate where a space is not assigned. It's always great if the franchisor reserves that right to operate anywhere where there's not a territory already assigned. On the territory end of things, the size of the territory, in many instances, folks have expressed concerns about giving away too much of the pie, if you will. That's a common problem with the new system where you are eager to get franchisees on board. You tend to sort of give away the kitchen sink. That's an issue. There are issues that can arise where a territory is defined by boundaries or defined by criteria that become indefinite over time. And zip codes is obviously one of those such things where zip codes change over time. And so you can run into issues with encroachment and those types of things where the territory, while it seemed like a good idea 10 years ago to define it that way, it's not so great today. Another issue is how to prepare for large population growth in a particular area where a territory might have been granted and it looked reasonable at the time based on population. I know we've had lots of population swells just in the North Texas area alone. One of the cities, Frisco, Texas, is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. If you looked at Frisco 15 years ago, it was primarily an agricultural area. There were farms there. I remember going there 15 years ago, and there was nothing there. It's a major populated city, and so franchisors are having to deal with some of those issues as well.
Funny you mentioned Frisco, because I spent a lot of time and staring at the windshield driving from Mesquite to Haltom City in the west in Fort Worth, all the way north, down south, and Frisco was never even on the map at that point. And Frisco actually should be named franchise heaven right now, as fast as it's growing and as many franchise locations are popping up in and around, you know, Frisco and Allen and what have you. You know, and you refer to, you know, population growth, and I have to immediately think about, you know, legacy franchise agreements, the ones, you know, from a long time ago that never even took into consideration, you know, population growth. You know, what are some of the more startling provisions you've encountered in legacy franchise agreement, and what was the fix?
One that comes to mind is not properly dealing with residual where there is a master arrangement. I'm thinking of a specific dispute where a system, this was one of those 20-year agreements, all right, came up for renewal. At that time, and by the way, so residual and performance criteria, this master franchisee had sort of essentially retired, but he was holding up growth. So the money that was flowing to this guy was great, but there was a lot of room for expansion. Because there were not performance criteria, and because the way the agreement was written, this guy was going to get his residual regardless, it created in a very uncomfortable situation at renewal, where a franchisor definitely needed to get someone else in there who was going to actively grow the business and take it to the next level. What happened in that case was actually a buyout was negotiated. So at some point, both had to give a little. It made sense for the franchisee who really was ready to retire and drink margaritas at the beach. It was nice to get a chunk of money up front. So that's how that issue was dealt with. And, of course, at 20 years ago, no one was really thinking about what to do with it.
Got a 20-year franchise agreement. So multiple choice question, what do you prefer, 5, 10, or 20-year agreements?
Well, what we see now is obviously shorter agreements. You just don't see those long ones out there. But the twist is obviously for a franchisee, they want to be able to recoup their investment. So 5 years, depending on the amount of money that you're putting in, is not going to work. But what you see now are those renewal terms where you get 2 or 3 renewal terms.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't even imagine a 20-year agreement. Thinking about where things were 20 years ago, it's hard to believe. So are there provisions that were once very common that have now fallen out of favor?
Well, it's interesting. One thing that I'll mention that sort of goes with the legacy and kind of in this category as well, there were some agreements where they were what we call a grandfather clause, where this was your agreement from now until you left the system. Those definitely, you don't see those. Those are definitely not out there anymore. Surprisingly, one area where there's been a lot of change just in the last 15 years is what franchisors think about these arbitration provisions. Now, when I started practicing, there was obviously a ramp up in use of arbitration provisions, and you know, as more and more cases were arbitrated, companies started to question whether arbitration was the way to go. Was it really all the hype that it was pitched about? So sure. Franchisors initially thought it was cheaper, faster. The truth is, over time, for some arbitrations, they started to look like a trial, where there was extensive discovery permitted and arbitrators had to be called upon like judges to sort of referee discovery disputes. And so the cost factor that was obviously nice because you don't have to pay a judge to listen to a trial, the cost oftentimes can creep up. what I've found is that a lot of franchisors are looking at their arbitration provisions and looking from a cost standpoint and from a process standpoint, which I'll come back to. On the cost, where they may have had a three-panel arbitration provision, they've gone to one arbitrator. What happened in some of the older agreements, you'd have the three-panel arbitration provision where each one would get to select an arbitrator. Those two would get together and select the third arbitrator. So obviously there's a cost because you're not only paying one arbitrator, you're paying three arbitrators, each side's paying their own lawyers. So it could get cost prohibitive pretty quickly. Another issue with arbitration is more on the process side of things and procedural. When an arbitrator renders an award, it's very difficult to set that aside. There have been sort of interesting decisions on both sides of things and sort of more to come in that area. But essentially, it's very difficult to set aside an arbitration award. So some of the franchisors are saying, hey, let's rethink arbitrations. Now, there's no mad rush to get rid of arbitrations, but that is one where we're seeing more discussion with the franchisors about whether that's the case.
Now, yeah, I remember back in the day where, you know, arbitration, I mean, it was, you know, the all that, and we had to have it in there. And
yes.
I think a big reason they did because it clearly defined, you know, the amount of money that the franchisor and franchisee would have to put up in order to enter into arbitration. I think a fee that I remember back in the day was $5,000. And I know a lot of franchisors thought about it as, you know, this is a deterrent right off the fact, like, you know, $5,000 wouldn't even get you through the door in any type of legal maneuvering these days. So it is interesting how things have changed. You know, shifting gears a bit, established and new franchisors oftentimes want to show the most attractive investment scenario in their item 7 of their FDD. In your opinion, what are some of the best practices for franchisors when it comes to calculating the estimated startup costs?
Okay, very, very good question. I'll start with kind of an interesting case that we talked about, and then we'll swing back a bit. In a case that we highlighted for the participants at the legal symposium was a case that involved startup fees that were 85% below the actual startup fees or cost. Now, that's a huge disparity when you consider the fact that not only has the franchisee relied upon those numbers, but the bank has looked at those numbers, they've looked at financing, so others have relied upon those numbers, and then to find out that the actual fees are cost are 85% more. Now, what's required in the initial investment section is a listing of all of the costs that the franchisor expects the franchisee to incur, whether they're paid to the franchisor, paid to an affiliate, or paid to a third party. Some of the baseline things that you include in there, obviously, is the initial fee, any cost for training, and realistically, you know, what it's going to cost beyond what's already included in the initial fee for training, cost for lease space. If that's going to vary, it's okay to include a range on it. Equipment, business license fees, related fees, any additional cost for training. Franchisors are also required to list what additional funds are going to be needed during an initial period. That's separate from sort of the listing of all the other things that those are to get the door open. What are the costs going to be? For the additional funds, the FTC requires that the franchisor estimate the cost for an initial startup period. The Federal Trade Commission has said 3 months is sort of an adequate amount of time for an initial period. Obviously, it might require a longer period depending on the industry, but you have to specify what that initial period is. And so the franchisor with each of these factors needs to be sitting down and figuring out what substantiation I've got for each of these numbers, because you're going to have to specify a number for each one of those, and you're going to be held accountable for what those numbers are. So you need to have backup. I tell my clients, however we determine these numbers, this is something that you keep on hand So if you ever get questioned later, you've got this information. One of the things is, even though you've done a good job as franchisor in collecting this information, a good practical thing is to talk to your franchisees after they're open. They'd be glad, and you go with the guise of, hey, you know, we want to know kind of what these costs really looked like for you. We want to make sure that we get our numbers right going forward. We want to make sure we got them right in this instance, and find out from the franchisees what it actually costs. That information, put that in your file as well. If you're tracking that information, that's something that's going to help in the event that you get hit with some type of litigation. In the case that we highlighted, this franchisor is going to have a hard row to hoe in this case, because the franchisor does not have that information. Now, this came up on a preliminary motion to dismiss, so the case will still need to be tried, so stay tuned for how it comes out. But where you've got the background and you can show here's a reasonable basis for why this number's in here or why we chose this range, that's, you know, you're going to be on better footing, more stable footing, if there's litigation later.
Interesting.
Hey, Ursa, you know, in preparing for the show, one of the topic suggestions that you gave related to drafting and enforcing non-competition provisions, but also the importance of policing your marks, and you had a little notation about naked licenses.
Yes.
First, what's the meaning of naked licenses for those snickering audience members who've been transported back to Sister Teresa's sixth grade class at Immaculate Heart School? And then we can go back to brand protection and non-competes, if
right.
you would.
Certainly, certainly. Naked license is not one of those that we typically see in the franchise context. There was an interesting case that we reported on, the Rex Chicken case, where the owners of a franchise and owners of a mark attempted to shut down the user of a mark. What happened in that case was the system had changed hands over time. So the original owner of the franchise, he had long passed on, and there were others running the system. Well, over time, they decided, oh, we're not really interested in franchising, but they have this franchisee out there using the marks. After a certain period of time, no one even checked, never did a quality assurance check. So this guy is out there solo using this mark for years. And all of a sudden, people realize this franchisee is out there, and they decide, well, we want to start growing this brand. We've got this Lone Ranger out here. How do we shut him down? So the alleged owners of the mark attempted to come in and take these marks back and limit the use of these marks. What happened was the user of the mark said, no, you have not policed your marks properly as required by the Lanham Act. As a result, a naked license has resulted. Now, keep in mind, in the underlying case, the license agreement or franchise agreement had long expired. So this person was operating without a license. But the court said, no, you've granted a naked license in that case. And what happens is that you lose control and ownership of that mark when you don't properly police it. That just really drives home the point that as a franchisor, owner of marks, it's your obligation and responsibility to know how your marks are doing, to know how your marks are being used, whether that is physical signage, advertising, or even on the Internet. As the franchisor, you have that responsibility.
Yeah, Ursa, when I was with Hardee's, we had done, before I got there, a number of acquisitions. Hardee's bought the Sandy's burger chain in the 1970s, and in 1981 or 82, they bought the Burger Chef chain. Most of those franchisees converted to Hardee's, but we did have a few franchisees who did not. We had one in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and someone in a small town in Tennessee. The Pittsfield, Mass. One eventually closed, but the Tennessee location kept on operating as a Burger Chef for quite some time, which, you know, required us to maintain the marks and make sure that we had control of them, because we didn't want to have a resulting naked license and lose control of those marks. So I would imagine that Hardee's probably still protects those marks because they bought that company in whole, even though I don't believe there's any operators left out there.
Right. I would imagine that they still are, because that's the proper way to police them if you intend to continue using them. There's a rebuttable presumption if you've not used them within 3 years, there's an intent not to reuse them. So it's really important in a scenario like that where you've got sort of the Lone Ranger out there that you continue meeting those obligations, continue policing those marks. Now, I'd like to jump back for a little bit, because the scenario that you gave creates an issue that might be worth mentioning in the neighborhood of ideal provisions in an agreement. This underscores why it's important the franchisor reserves the right to franchise other marks, because if the franchisor obtains a competing brand, you might run into encroachment issues. And so it's important that you reserve the right to do that in your agreement, operate under another name, offer licenses under another name, so that if that scenario comes up, because what if you've got with the Burger Chef where you've got a Hardee's next door, all of a sudden you're supporting two franchisees and they're probably within that 2 mile or 5 mile or whatever the mile radius is. So it's important in your franchise agreement that you properly reserve the right to do that, so you don't run into a fight with current franchisees. I'd like to highlight just a bit on the non-compete and protecting the brand, because that's really important. We talked about a Fantastic Sam's case that really drives home sort of a basic point on being specific with regards to the terms in the agreement. It's not enough to just say a competing business or that competes with Fantastic Sam's. It's really important to specify the type of business. Be very specific in the Fantastic Sam's case that we highlighted, the mile radius and the duration, there was not an issue with that. What the court took issue with was a very broad description of a competing business. So this is really a good practice point for franchisors to go back, look at their non-compete, because I guarantee you Fantastic Sam's has enforced this very broad, what the court said is unenforceable agreement, many, many times over the years. This is a good time for franchisors to dust off the non-compete, see what it says, and figure out whether there are some ways that they can bolster the agreement in the event that they get a challenge. But non-competes are really a critical way that franchisors protect their brands. The typical non-compete says to franchisee, you're going to be out of this business for a certain period of time in a certain geographic range for this particular type of business. And it's important, obviously, on the franchisee side that they understand that, and it's critical to not only protecting the franchisor, but other franchisees. It's not fair for a franchisee to leave the system with the knowledge of that system to improperly compete. You can see that a franchisee, obviously, they know price points, they know how the operations go, so it'd be fairly easy to undercut or use that knowledge. And so the non-compete is not only to protect the brand, but it's to protect other franchisees in the brand.
You know, I definitely see another show in our future with you, Ursa, about non-competes, and I already have the title, What to Do When, dot, dot, dot. You know,
right.
there was another symposium topic, getting ahead of the curve, controlling the risk of social media, and I've got a bite on this because it's near and dear to my heart. I use social media a lot myself and for my clients, and probably one of the only ones out there that are doing so strictly from a franchising perspective as opposed to coming at it from a marketing perspective because of my years in franchising. So I guess the million-dollar question as we wrap up the show is, how do we get ahead of the social media curve and manage risk?
Very good question, and you're right. This is a hot topic, could be an entire program by itself. I'll be brief and try and give some good pointers for any franchisors out there listening. First of all, there should be a written social media policy. During the symposium, we talked about some of the policies that are out there and some of the typical things that are in those policies. It's important to work with franchisees to get franchisees' input also, because as the franchisor, we don't definitely don't know everything that we need to know in this space. But it's important to make sure that whatever those requirements are, if it's running it by the franchisor, going through everything that's posted, goes through the franchisor's website, frequency of posting, if there are going to be blogs out there. But a written policy is really critical because that's going to educate the franchisees on what they can and can't do. We talked about sort of dealing with crisis because one of the things that's surely out there is sort of bad publicity and how you deal with that publicity and how you deal with this area. Because surely there are going to be those risks out there. Everyone probably knows about the video that was put out about the airline who broke the guitar. That was one of those that went viral very quickly. But what do you do in a scenario like that? The important thing beforehand is to think about a crisis and how we manage that crisis. Who's going to be at the forefront? What are we going to need to do? Because you're going to need to get people rallied together in a matter of hours, not days. And so thinking through those things and who's going to sort of be the front person, we had a great presenter at the symposium that talked about some of the more successful responses to crisis and using social media as a way to get out there quickly, talked about regular programming sort of being too slow, and the newspaper certainly is too slow to respond, but even regular TV programming where, as in a matter of hours, you can be on the Internet responding to the crisis. There were some really, really good examples shared with the group where folks got out there, they addressed the issue immediately, they were able to reach their constituents or address the problem right away, same day, and get out there and use social media to their benefit that way, because clearly there are going to be issues out there. If there's not something in the franchise agreement itself about parameters for social media, franchisors certainly need to get that in their agreement. For sure, because it's just like one consultant mentioned a funny question he had with regards to internet with regards to email and the internet many, many years ago. One of the companies that he was working with said, "If we don't move to the internet, are we going to be behind in 5 years?" It's kind of the same thing with social media. If you're not there already or thinking about the policies or how you're going to deal with Facebook, how you're going to deal with Twitter, how you're going to deal with Yelp, how you're going to deal with complaints and all of that, if you're not doing that already, you're going to be behind in 5 years.
Yeah, I'd have to take a slight disagreement there and say you're going to be behind in a year.
Right.
I've been trying to keep up with this and how it relates to franchise space, and it's absolutely ridiculous, and I got so overwhelmed of late by all the changes at Google, I mean day in and day out, that I had all these articles, and I said, where am I going to put this all for reference? And I said, I put it on a cloud, do I set up a file? And I actually set up Google for Franchises page on Facebook, figured it's a resource for myself but also for everybody else, and it's amazing how many people have liked the page and come to it day in and day out. So great information today, Ursa. I really appreciate it. I think you just gave us a wonderful and informative overview of the legal symposium, and I really appreciate that and look forward to having you back again as a guest on Franchise Today. Thank you.
Certainly, with glad to come back on the show.
Well, Joe, another legal series on the books. Fantastic job on that. I think a ton of information out there, and also just a fabulous year three for Franchise Today on Blog Talk Radio. Definitely could not have been as successful without you.
Well, thank you, and Ursa, you're right, did a wonderful job today cramming a three-day symposium into a one-hour show, kind of a whirlwind review of what happened, and very, very informative, and I'm sure the audience members will get a lot out of it, and will be sharing this with their peers.
Well, Ursa, certainly... tongue in cheek, you definitely speak a lot quicker than most Dallas attorneys.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I love it. Well, you know, Joe, as I said at the beginning of the show, we're now going on summer break. all the episodes of the legal series, as well as the second one and the first one. So our last 3 years' worth of legal series we'll have on demand each Thursday, probably working backwards or forwards. I'm not sure yet. I might pull them up a bit just for a little bit of variety and maybe pull some of the segments that make sense together, and maybe some of the attorneys, like I know we've had Michael Webster on 3 times. Maybe I'll do 3 shows in a row with him. I don't know. We'll juggle that around, but it should be a great informative summer. I love it when franchisors continue to come to us and say, and they're using this fabulous information, not only from the legal series, but the entire Franchise Today programs as a basis for internal training of staff, because at the end of the day, that's what this is all about. It's about best practices in franchising, and I know you and I have a very similar philosophy with respect to that.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and this is a great project, Franchise Today, and I'm happy that it benefits so many people.
So until the Thursday after Labor Day, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great, 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 wonderful thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.